Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 108. It's Monday, April 5th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, COVID-19 is still dominating the public health news. Let's start off with an article from the Washington Post. Are we entering a fourth wave of the pandemic? Experts disagree. I will weigh in afterwards. The data doesn't look good. After weeks of decline, the average number of new coronavirus infections reported each day is higher than it's been in a month. The number of people in hospitals with COVID-19 has been stubbornly stagnant since mid-March. And even as highly contagious viral variants spread, state leaders are relaxing safety precautions. By now, this is a familiar script, but this time around, the country's leading epidemiologists disagree about what to call this latest phase of the pandemic. Is the United States on the cusp of a fourth wave, or are we instead seeing the last gasps of a crisis in its 14th month? Most recently, the debate played out on the Sunday morning news shows. Michael Osterholm, advisor for President Biden's coronavirus task force, said on NBC's Meet the Press that the next 2 weeks will bring, quote, the highest number of cases reported globally since the beginning of the pandemic. Remember, folks, this is a pandemic. In terms of the United States, we're just at the beginning of this surge, said Osterholm, who is also director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. We haven't even really begun to see it. The pandemic has been cyclical, he said. Cases pile up in the Northeast or the Midwest, subside, and then swell in the South. And we're now, I think, in that cycle where the upper Midwest is just now beginning to start this fourth surge, Osterholm said, calling Michigan's latest case numbers a wake-up call. The Great Lakes state has for nearly 50 days reported increasing numbers of coronavirus infections, a trend that ran counter to the nation until recently, according to data tracked and analyzed by the Washington Post. Over the past week, Michigan has reported an average of 6,500 new cases per day, rivaling levels seen during its record-setting winter surge. It has recorded the second most cases of the variant first identified in the United Kingdom, according to CDC data. And I will clarify, that's the absolute number, but if you look at the rate based on population, it's actually the highest rate in the country. Okay. Cases are also on the rise elsewhere. In the Midwestern Plains, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania are among the states that have reported large increases. In the Northeast, states such as Delaware, Vermont, and Maine have witnessed a similar incline. By the numbers, this latest upswing is on par with the surges of cases in July. Going into the weekend, the country was reporting more than 65,000 cases per day, a number that didn't include several states that did not report data on the Good Friday holiday. That figure is roughly the same as last summer's peak, when soaring case counts were alarming public health officials and overwhelming some hospitals. On CBS's Face the Nation, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb predicted the current spikes would not amount to, quote, a true fourth wave, citing the number of Americans who have already been infected, plus the number of people who have been vaccinated. I think that there is enough immunity in the population that we're not going to see a true fourth wave of infection, Gottlieb said. What we're seeing is pockets of infection around the country, particularly in younger people who have not been vaccinated and also in school-age children. Early in the week, Tony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, also cast doubt on the prospect of another national surge, saying vaccines are the X factor that was absent during the first summer and winter waves. It's kind of like a race between the potential for a surge and our ability to vaccinate as many people as we possibly can, Fauci said. And hopefully, if you want to make this a metaphorical race, the vaccine is going to win this one. Those comments came a few days after Rochelle Walensky, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, sounded the largest alarm yet about the coming weeks. Quote, I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom, she said at a White House briefing last week. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason to hope. But right now, I'm scared. Experts do agree that the trends are troubling and that they can be traced to a convergence of factors, increased spread of the more transmissible variants, and a broad loosening of public health measures, such as mask mandates and limits on indoor dining. Biden pleaded with cities and states that have lifted precautions to reinstate them. Please, this is not politics, he said last week. Reinstate the mandate if you let it down, and businesses should require masks as well. A failure to take this virus seriously, precisely what got us into this mess in the first place, risks more cases and more deaths. Still, there are unanswered questions that continue to complicate the U.S. response. Among the biggest, Gottlieb argued on Sunday, is whether variants of the virus are reinfecting people. We should have that information, but we don't, added Gottlieb, who has encouraged the CDC to gather information about reinfections. So there's a lot we don't understand about this virus right now. Now remember, earlier in the article, Gottlieb was the one that was more optimistic. I would point out this is a huge thing that we don't necessarily know, although there are things we do know, that this Brazilian variant and the so-called South African variant do cause reinfections of people who have already been infected. So him relying on naturally acquired immunity from previous infection may be thrown out the window, and that could be a game changer. That's what we don't know. But what we do know, if that's the case, which it probably will be over time, again, it's a matter of timing. If we didn't do anything, then invariably in several months, these variants would rise and cause that to be a problem. The question is, again, a race. Do we get there before with a lot of vaccination coverage or not? And of course, the most important marker for vaccination coverage is what we call herd immunity, when you have enough people vaccinated that the virus cannot thrive at all and it goes extinct or down to a level that you can actually control, which has never been the case since the beginning of this epidemic, since last year. So to get to some of this, the Kaiser Health News reports this. COVID vaccine hesitancy drops among all Americans, new survey shows. This was showing that there was 62% of the people that were either already received the vaccine or were planning to get it as soon as possible. That's good news. There was 1/6 of the population, 17%, that were in the wait and see category. But 20% of the population was in the definitely not or only if required. And most of those were in the definitely not. That's hung around 13 to 15% over the last several months. So when we're talking about herd immunity being somewhere between 70 and 85%, if we've got 15 or 20% of the people who are really not keen on getting this at all, and maybe even just an absolute refusers, that means almost all of your wait and see people are going to have to wait and see and get it, hopefully sooner than later. And of course, with these variants, it might push the herd immunity number up higher because they are, in fact, more infectious. Okay, more on the survey data. Among all groups, Republicans and white evangelical Christians were the most likely to say they will not get vaccinated, with almost 30% of each group saying they will definitely not get a shot. But Republicans and white evangelical Christians, along with 21% of essential workers in non-health fields and 20% of rural residents, were the most likely to say they will definitely not get vaccinated. So I think this 20% of rural residents, because that's a geographical thing, it shows you that an epidemic could very well go on and on and on in rural areas. And I do find it's interesting that there are 21% of essential workers in non-health fields. That means a lot of people on the front lines that could potentially be exposed and transmit, you know, on and on and on. This is not over yet. So the big question about answering this, is this like a fourth wave? It really comes down to me for at what level or levels of vaccination will various communities converge over the next 4 to 6 months? Put more prosaically, I would say, this is the way I think of it. Will America spike the football on the 5-yard line? And sticking with this football metaphor, here we go. America is running in open field, ready to cross the opponent's 20-yard line. Will America spike the football on the 5-yard line? We have our best blocker, vaccinations, running at our side, at our right-hand side. We have another blocker, acquired immunity from infection, running at our left side. However, we are being chased by deadly variants. A couple of so-called UK variant opponents are right behind us, close enough to potentially catch us. Behind us, on our left and our right, are a couple of mutant opponents, both bigger and faster. The so-called South Africa variant and the Brazilian variant. Each of them can overcome our second-class blocker, that is, acquired immunity from infection and cause reinfection, grabbing at our jersey. At this point, our best defense is speed, but we are slowing our so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as masking and social distancing. We are excitedly looking forward to our next season, baseball season, a different Grant game, so much so that we are considering spiking the football at the 5-yard line so we can get on with it. But this game, this season, is not over. We may be able to spike the football at the 5-yard line and still win the game, but we may have to line up against our opponents without an open field advantage, where speed can crush our opponent's chances of victory. Of course, we can slog it out and likely win, eventually. But of course, isn't slogging it out precisely what we are tired of? I say let's finish the game, let's finish the season. And again, for re-emphasis, the real danger here of the fourth wave, or whatever you want to call it, is that reinfection from these Brazilian and South African so-called variants can take out much of our defenses. Plus, the more infectious and deadly variants can push herd immunity potentially out of reach for wide swaths of America. Okay, well, let's get to more news. We can put this under the category of expect the unexpected, under what we don't know. And as a former Eagle Scout, one thing you may not have known about me, the Boy Scout motto of be prepared. This from Reuters. The U.S. puts J&J in charge of plant that botched COVID vaccine and removes AstraZeneca. The United States has put Johnson & Johnson in charge of a plant that ruined 15 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine and has stopped British drug maker AstraZeneca from using a facility, a senior health official said on Saturday. J&J said it was assuming full responsibility of the Emergent BioSolutions facility in Baltimore, reiterating that it will deliver 100 million doses to the government by the end of May as promised. In a separate statement late Sunday, Emergent said it expects to align with the U.S. government and AstraZeneca to ramp down manufacturing for AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine at its Baltimore plant. The government's move to have the facility make only the J&J single-dose vaccine is meant to avoid future mix-ups, the New York Times said, citing two senior federal health officials.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to some better news, please. From the Hill, Pfizer says vaccine 100% effective in kids 12 to 15. Pfizer and BioNTech announced that their COVID-19 vaccine is 100% effective in children ages 12 to 15. The vaccines were effective and generated robust antibody responses in a clinical trial of 2,260 adolescents. And the company said in a statement, 18 coronavirus cases were identified in the placebo group compared to 0 cases among those vaccinated. The company said they plan to submit their data to the Food and Drug Administration as soon as possible and request expansion of their emergency use authorization. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said he hopes to start vaccinating the younger age group before the start of the next school year. First authorized in December, the Pfizer vaccine is currently authorized for those aged 16 years old and older. The company has also begun a clinical trial of the vaccine in children ages 6 to 11. Meanwhile, Moderna announced this month that it is also testing its vaccine on children between the ages of 6 months and 12 years old in the U.S. and Canada. And next up from the Hill, something you haven't heard a whole lot of lately about COVID-19 testing. FDA authorizes 2 rapid at-home COVID-19 tests in major move. The FDA has authorized rapid tests from 2 companies in a major step forward for the availability of at-home COVID-19 testing. The authorizations of the Quidel QuickView and the Abbott Binax Now tests will allow people to swab themselves at home and get results in minutes. The Quidel test delivers results in 10 minutes and the Abbott test requires 15 minutes. While the FDA has previously taken some steps towards authorizing at-home tests, advocates hailed the new authorizations as a major breakthrough because the tests are simple, do not require a prescription, and can be mass-produced by 2 major companies to be widely available. An Abbott spokesman said the company has the ability to make, quote, tens of millions per month. Abbott will begin shipping to major food, drug, and mass merchandiser retailers in the coming weeks, the company said. Michael Minna, a Harvard expert who has been pushing the FDA for months to do more to authorize simple rapid tests, hailed the announcement on Twitter as, quote, big news, all caps. Simple, streamlined rapid tests will be available in the U.S., he wrote. Okay, well, we're still playing the long game here. This from Medical Express. Almost 1 in 7 suffers from long COVID, UK study finds. Nearly 1 in 7 Britons who tested positive for COVID-19 continue to have symptoms for at least 12 weeks, according to a UK study. The Office for National Statistics said the study of over 20,000 people who had tested positive from April last year through March this year found 13.7% had symptoms that lasted for at least 12 weeks. Okay, well, while the country debates infrastructure, want to put in a plug for the fact that infrastructure does equal public health. This from The Guardian. Ban of U.S. water shutoffs could have prevented thousands of COVID deaths, says a study. A national moratorium on water shutoffs could have prevented almost 500,000 COVID infections and saved at least 9,000 lives, according to new research. Good hygiene is essential to preventing the spread of the highly contagious coronavirus. Amid pressure from public health experts and rights groups, hundreds of utilities and states suspended disconnections for overdue bills to ensure households kept running water for hand washing and sanitation. But many refused. Others let the bans expire after a few months, and Congress refused to step in with a national moratorium. By the end of 2020, 211 million Americans, including a disproportionate number of households of color, faced the threat of having their taps turned off during the worst public health and economic crisis in modern history. This patchwork protection cost thousands of American lives between April and December last year, according to research by Cornell University and the national advocacy group Food and Water Watch. Researchers found that states which suspended disconnection significantly reduced their growth rates of COVID infections and deaths compared to states without similar orders. The biggest reduction was seen in states with comprehensive bans covering all private and public utilities. If similar policies had been adopted across the U.S., the study model shows that COVID cases might have been reduced by 4% and deaths by 5.5% in the 41 states without a full moratorium. This research clearly shows that the pain and suffering caused by the pandemic was exacerbated by political leaders who failed to take action to keep the water flowing for struggling families, said Winona Hauter, Food and Water Watch's executive director. The findings come amid growing pressure on Michigan and New York State officials to extend their state moratoriums, both of which expire at the end of March. Failure to do so would leave a further 27 million people at risk of losing their water supplies for unpaid bills as concerns grow about a potential third wave. Advocates are also urging Joe Biden to impose a national moratorium and make water a priority in the forthcoming infrastructure bill. An investigation by The Guardian last year found millions of Americans were facing unaffordable bills even before the pandemic, as aging infrastructure, environmental cleanups, changing demographics, and the climate emergency fueled exponential price hikes in almost every corner of the U.S. Federal funding for water systems has plummeted since peaking in 1977. Mildred Warner, a professor of local government at Cornell University, said, "This study shows the importance of a national standard for access to water, especially for low-income households. The COVID-19 pandemic has revealed so many structural inequities in our society, and access to drinking water is one that demands our attention." Okay, well, let's do our local COVID-19 update. Of course, the important context continues to be that Michigan is the epicenter of the epidemic in America today. And just last week, they officially identified the Brazilian variant in the thumb, where if you look on the map, it's all red with the highest rates. Surprise, surprise. It always seems like we're three steps behind. But we learn the truth eventually. But let's be interventionists, not just historians. Okay, well, the Lucas County average daily cases moved up from 100 last week to 119 as of Friday. This is not quite a full week because of the Easter holidays. There was no reporting over the weekend. So we saw about a 20% increase over the last week. Still, 64 of 88 Ohio counties have a high incidence of COVID-19. This is no change in the number of counties with high incidence from the previous week. That was actually getting better for a few weeks, but it looks like that's leveled off. We'll see if that gets worse. Okay, well, in Lucas County, it's definitely getting worse, and it's getting worse relatively fast. Looking at testing positivity rates, the percentage of people who get a test that test positive. 2 weeks ago, that was 6.6%. Now it is 10%. Not good. It is lower, but also rising at the state level, where the state as a whole has a testing positivity rate of 4.2% compared to 3.5% from the week before. We are also seeing a trend in Lucas County in active cases in nursing homes. It's up a bit. We had gotten down to 4 or 5 active cases per week a few weeks ago, but it's been rising slowly but steadily the last several weeks, and we're up to 16 active cases. That's 3 residents and 13 staff, which of course shows you that we're not completely protected. Even those are a priority congregate care living facilities. And if you'll remember from previous reporting, a lot of folks that are working in these long-term care facilities declined to get immunized, so they're still vulnerable. That's probably one reason why you're seeing a lot more of the staff infected than the residents, because the residents are way more likely to have taken the vaccine. Okay, well, new hospitalizations are trending up in both Lucas County and Ohio in the last week. The Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days, we've only had 10 deaths in the last 14 days reported, and this is lower than the state and national rates, so that's good. Okay, well, University of Toledo only had 7 positive cases reported. They only found one through their random surveillance testing for a 0.2 positivity rate. Okay, pretty good for UT. Way to go. Of course, they're vaccinating people on campus, too. Lucas County Schools had kind of a bump up. They had 84 identified infections, 15 staff and 69 students, and this has gone up over the last several weeks, although because we don't have a regular program of testing, it's really hard to interpret that other than possibly a trend up. Okay, vaccinations. Well, we're holding at about 32% of people that have received one or more doses. That's basically true with the U.S., Ohio, and Lucas County level. Lucas County is lagging just slightly from the state and national in the proportion of people having received their first doses. And for the last month or so, I've been looking at the racial ethnic disparities in vaccinations. And what we see is that for Lucas County, in Lucas County, black persons are 46% as likely to be vaccinated as whites. And that is essentially held steady for the last month. In Ohio, it's edged up slightly to 53% from 49% a few weeks ago. But it was over a month ago that Lucas County had a nice little media press conference and talked about their initiative to bolster vaccinations in communities of color. Well, I must say, it has not budged. So we still have vaccine equity issues that are not getting better. Okay, of course, if you need to get a vaccination, everybody in Ohio over the age 16 plus is eligible. You can go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. In Lucas County, you can dial 211 if you need language assistance or have poor internet access. If you're over 65, you can call the Area Office of Aging at 419-382-0624. Or Lucas County residents can visit any library branch to schedule an appointment or call 419-259-5200. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. You're listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Okay, well, I want to switch gears and do a series of stories here on gun violence. This from Medical Express. Mass shootings are rare, but firearm suicides are common and kill more Americans every year. As a criminal justice researcher, I study gun purchasing and mass shootings, and it's clear to me that these events are traumatic for victims, families, communities, and the nation as a whole. But despite the despair about their slightly growing frequency, they are actually uncommon incidents that account for just 0.2% of firearm deaths in the U.S. each year. Killings are not the only kind of gun violence, and are in fact a relative rarity when compared to other forms of gun violence in the U.S. According to the National Crime Victimization Survey, about 471,000 people were victims of crimes that involved a firearm in 2018 and 482,000 in 2019. Each person is counted separately, even if several of them were part of the same incident, and this tally does not require the gun to be fired or anyone to be killed. When it comes to people killed by firearms, police data reported to the FBI estimates that guns were used in over 10,000 of the about almost 14,000 homicides that occurred in 2019. That's much higher than even the uppermost count of mass shootings in 2019, the 417 deaths recorded by the Gun Violence Archive. That group counts all incidents in which at least four people are shot, excluding the shooter, regardless of whether the shooter is killed or injured. It also includes events that involve gang violence or armed robbery, as well as shootings that occurred in public or in private homes, as many domestic violence shootings do. The most recent research on frequency of mass shootings indicates they are becoming more common, though the exact number each year can vary widely. Suicide is the leading form of gun death. In 2019, the 417 mass shootings tally by the Gun Violence Archive resulted in 465 deaths. By contrast, 14,414 people were killed by someone else with a gun in 2019, and 23,941 people intentionally killed themselves with a gun in 2019, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Every year, homicides, one person killing another, make up about 35% of gun deaths. More than 60% of gun deaths are suicides. Mass shootings can get more attention than these other more common types of firearm deaths, both because of human nature and the news media. People are naturally curious about violent events that appear random, with no clear explanation. Those incidents often spark fears about whether similar things could happen to them, and a resulting desire to know more in an effort to understand. In addition, cases with higher death counts or unusual characteristics, such as a shooter manifesto or video footage, are more likely to get press attention and extended coverage. Okay, next up from the American Journal of Public Health. Effects of laws expanding civilian rights to use deadly force in self-defense on violence and crime, a systematic review. Since 2005, most U.S. states have expanded civilian rights to use deadly force in self-defense outside the home. In most cases, legislation has included removing the duty to retreat anywhere one may legally be, commonly known as stand-your-ground laws. The extent to which these laws affect public health and safety is widely debated in public and policy discourse. The main results? Stand your ground laws were associated with no change to small increases in violent crime, total and firearm homicide, aggravated assault, and robbery on average across states. Florida-based studies showed robust increases, 24 to 45%, in firearm and total homicide, while self-defense claims under stand your ground laws were more often denied when victims were white, especially when defendants were racial minorities. Authors' conclusions? The existing evidence contradicts claims that expanding self-defense laws deters violent crime across the United States. In at least some contexts, including Florida, stand your ground laws are associated with increases in violence, and there are racial inequities in the application of these laws. Okay, and moving to youth gun violence, this from Medical Express. Intentional youth firearm injuries linked to sociodemographic factors. Firearm injuries are a leading and preventable cause of death and injury among youth, responsible for an estimated 5,000 deaths and 22,000 non-fatal injury hospital visits each year in American kids. And while hospital systems are poised to tackle this issue using a public health approach, prevention efforts and policies may be differentially effective. A new study led by researchers at Children's National Hospital finds the sociodemographic factors related to intent of injury by firearm may be useful in guiding policy and informing tailored interventions for the prevention of firearm injuries in at-risk youth. We sought to explore differences by injury intent in a nationally representative sample of youth presenting to the emergency department with firearm injury, said Shilpa Patel, MD, MPH, emergency medicine physician at Children's National Hospital. We are hopeful that hospitals will support programs that are targeted, patient-centered, and relevant to their communities to prevent firearm injury among youth. In one of the first comparative studies of factors and outcomes associated with intentionality of youth firearm injury in a large nationally representative sample, researchers identified more than 178,000 hospital visits for firearm injuries with data collected from the nationwide emergency department sample from 2009 through 2016. Dr. Patel and her colleagues identified distinct risk profiles for individuals aged 21 and younger who arrived at emergency departments with firearm injuries over an 8-year period. Using the emergency department data, researchers found that approximately 1/3 of the injuries were categorized as unintentional, another 1/3 as assault, and a small proportion as self-harm. The majority of visits were among youth age 18 to 21 years, with almost 90% male and more than 40% publicly insured. Nearly 1/3 were admitted to the hospital, and 6% died as a result of their firearm injuries. In addition, the study showed that the likelihood of unintentional injury was higher among children aged 12 and younger. These findings provide insight into the overlap between risk factors, outcomes, and intentionality of youth firearm injury, says Dr. Shilpa. For hospitals looking to implement programs to reduce youth firearm injury, distinct risk profiles identified in our study align with prior evidence to support the following. Screen for firearm access and provide counseling on safe storage targeting families with younger children. Screen suicidal patients for access to lethal means, especially those hospitals in rural areas. And screen for firearm access, especially among children exposed to violence or at risk for assault presenting to urban hospitals. Okay, next up also from Medical Express. 1 in 5 Colorado high school students has access to firearms. 20% of high school students have easy access to a handgun, according to a new study from the Colorado School of Public Health. In the study published in Pediatrics, the researchers examined the prevalence of handgun access among adolescents in Colorado and explored individual and geographic characteristics as well as related health factors. Our findings highlight that it is relatively easy to access a handgun in Colorado for high school students. This finding, combined with the high prevalence of feeling sad or depressed and suicide attempts, is concerning for the safety of adolescents, lead author Ashley Brooks Russell from the Colorado School of Public Health said. They found that students were significantly more likely to report easy handgun access if they felt sad or hopeless almost every day for 2 weeks, about 25%. Those that attempted suicide, 30%, or had been in a physical fight in the past 12 months, 32%. The survey data also revealed more male than female high school students reported handgun access. A significantly higher proportion of transgender youth reported access. Students in more rural areas were more likely to have access. American Indian, multiracial students, followed by white students, access to handguns was significantly higher than among Hispanic, Black, or African American or Asian American students. It's clear from our findings that we need to raise awareness and improve efforts to reduce firearm access for youth in Colorado to prevent suicide and fatal injuries, said Brooks Russell. We hope our findings will help inform public health strategies, such as educating parents on the importance of secure home firearm storage, particularly if an adolescent is at risk for suicide. Recently, Colorado lawmakers advanced a safe storage of firearms bill to require Colorado gun owners who share their homes with children to securely store their weapons. It passed its first committee on a party line vote. Gee, I wonder which party voted which way. And to drive that last story's point home, this also from Medical Express. Children may have access to more access to guns than their parents may believe. New research by Carmel Saleh, a Northeastern professor, shows that 70% of parents believe their children cannot access the guns they keep in their homes. The children tell a different story. More than one-third of adolescents aged 13 to 17 say they could gain access in less than 5 minutes to a loaded firearm kept in the home, and half could gain access in 60 minutes or less. It was really shocking to see that half of the children in homes with guns reported being able to get a loaded gun in under an hour. Saleh says the nationally representative survey, which includes 280 families with children who keep firearms in the home, serves as a warning to parents that a home with guns isn't as safe as they thought they may have been. He says the focus should be on adolescents' access to firearms, because 30% of parents admitted that their children had access to guns in the home. Also, he adds, locking away the guns doesn't necessarily cut off access. Most of the messaging around reducing firearms access for adolescents has been around locking guns, Saleh says. The number of adolescents who have ready access to a gun in the home is really startling to see, and that points to this being a public health issue. Previous research by Northeastern's Matt Miller, a co-author of the study, has shown that people who own a handgun are almost four times more likely to die by suicide than those who don't have guns. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among people under 35 in the United States. Saleh's work pairs with earlier research by Miller, revealing that healthcare workers rarely discuss firearm safety with their patients. These studies help reveal the need for a public health approach to gun safety, says Miller. These conversations in a medical setting rarely occur with gun owners, even when there are children in the house. Access to a loaded firearm, which Dr. Saleh's work indicates is all too common, means that impulsive suicidal behavior is more likely to result in death than if guns were less accessible to adolescents in this country. The American Public Health Association, a century-old organization of public health professionals with more than 25,000 members worldwide, cites gun violence as a leading cause of premature death in the United States. A national record of more than 43,000 people were killed by gun violence in 2020, according to the Gun Violence Archive, including more than 24,000 people who died by suicide. Research released by Miller in 2020 showed that access to a gun makes it four times more likely that the suicide resulted in death than if there were no gun involved. Suicide is impulsive, says Saleh. Prevention is much more likely to be effective than trying to predict it. Saleh says the next step is to conduct research that shows how adolescents gain access to guns in their household, regardless of whether they are locked. In addition to the primary focus on suicide, there also is reason to fear the potential for accidents when children gain access to firearms. This is also a message about unintentional firearm death and injury. When children have guns in an unsupervised environment, they face a higher risk of injury. Okay, well, I'd like to really switch gears now and talk about work life, burnout, moral injury, job satisfaction and happiness, and health risks due to work. So I got this email letter from Physicians for a National Health Program, and at the beginning, it was one of the most succinct statements of the difference between burnout and moral injury. I've reported on moral injury before, and this is a good follow-up. So it starts, "Dear Medicare for All Advocate, as a retired psychiatrist and longtime member of Physicians for a National Health Program, I've had countless conversations with fellow providers about catastrophic levels of burnout, but what I am really hearing my colleagues describe is moral injury. What's the difference? Burnout suggests the problem and the solution rests with the individual, while moral injury suggests that the system is the problem and the system needs to change. These feelings are especially powerful among my fellow mental health providers, whose work is consistently undermined by the whims of commercial insurers. The frustration, guilt, and shame that we feel when insurance companies prevent us from providing quality care is actually a normal response to an abnormal, unhealthy, and stress-inducing system. It is normal to feel helpless when you are prevented from providing your patients the best care because of cost. To feel angry when patients lose their job and their health insurance but still need our care. And to feel maddeningly frustrated when you get a patient stabilized on a medication regimen, but their insurance company won't cover it. And while both burnout and moral injury are public health issues, this is a good example of how public health looks at the population and systems as a whole as a, quote, patient, rather than merely individuals. And while individuals might be able to do some things to mitigate some of the worst effects of moral injury, the fact is it's a systemic cause that's outside of the control of most individuals. Okay, this next story may be a myth buster from Science Daily. Degrees of happiness? Formal education does not lead to greater job satisfaction. Education is considered one of the most critical personal capital investments. But formal educational attainment doesn't necessarily pay off in job satisfaction, according to new research from the University of Notre Dame. In fact, there's almost no relationship between the two. According to Does Educational Attainment Promote Job Satisfaction? The bittersweet trade-offs between job resources, demands, and stress, forthcoming in the Journal of Applied Psychology. Our study shows people who have invested in formal education do not tend to be more satisfied with their jobs. We found that better educated individuals do enjoy greater job-related resources, including income, job autonomy, and variety, but they also endure longer work hours and increased job pressure, intensity, and urgency. On average, these demands are associated with increased stress and decreased job satisfaction, largely offsetting the positive gains associated with greater resources. In supplemental analyses, the team found that women were more likely to experience an increased negative association between education and job satisfaction, and self-employed individuals experience a reduced negative association. Relative to traditional occupations, self-employment offers considerable flexibility to organize one's work schedule, choose the work content, and decide how to respond to job demands. We found that, compared to their wage-employed counterparts, those in self-employment seem to be more insulated from the adverse effects of education on job stress and satisfaction. We believe illuminating this boundary condition is notable for the educated and organizations that value and want to retain their educated employees. Many people pursue higher education to get a better job on paper, not realizing that this, quote, better job isn't actually better due to the unanticipated effects of demands and stress over time. It's good for people to be realistic about the career paths they pursue and what they ultimately value. And lastly but not leastly, in this trio of articles from Medical Express, working long hours may increase odds of second heart attack. Among patients who return to work after a heart attack, those who work more than 55 hours per week, compared to those working an average full-time job of 35 to 40 hours a week, increase their odds of having a second heart attack by about twofold, according to a prospective cohort study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Yes, folks, work may kill you. And excessive work, more so. Okay, well, next up I have a trio of articles getting at the limits of prescription drugs. This from Science Daily. Non-drug therapies as good as or better than drugs for treating depression in people with dementia. Non-drug therapies as good as or better than drugs for treating depression in people with dementia. Doctors should consider more social prescribing of non-drug approaches for depression and loneliness, says researchers. Non-drug therapies such as exercise appear to be as or more effective than drugs for reducing symptoms of depression in people with dementia, suggests research published online in the British Medical Journal. The findings suggest that people with dementia will derive a clinically meaningful benefit from non-drug interventions. And the researchers say doctors should consider more social prescribing of non-drug approaches to treat symptoms of depression and loneliness. 50 million people worldwide have a diagnosis of dementia. About 16% of these people also have a diagnosed major depressive disorder, and 32% will experience symptoms of depression without a formal diagnosis. Drug approaches alone were no more effective than usual care, but they found 10 interventions associated with a greater reduction in symptoms of depression compared with usual care. These were cognitive stimulation, exercise, reminiscence therapy, a treatment to help people with dementia remember events, people, and places in their lives, cognitive stimulation with a cholinesterase inhibitor, that is a drug used to treat dementia, massage and touch therapy, multidisciplinary care, psychotherapy combined with reminiscence therapy and environmental modification, occupational therapy, exercise combined with social interaction and cognitive stimulation, and animal therapy. Three interventions, massage and touch therapy, cognitive stimulation with cholinesterase inhibitor, and cognitive stimulation combined with exercise and social interaction, were found to be more effective than some drugs. And the next couple stories are on the power of the placebo from Science Daily. First of its kind study compares performance of open-label placebo to blinded placebo. For decades, the power of the placebo effect was thought to lie in patients' belief that they were, or at least could be, receiving a pharmacologically active ingredient, treatment. A new study by physician researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that patients don't need to be deceived to receive benefit from treatment from placebo. In a randomized clinical trial published in the journal Pain, researchers found participants with moderate to severe irritable bowel syndrome who were knowingly treated with a pharmacologically inactive pill, referred to as an honest or open-label placebo, reported clinically meaningful improvements in their irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. People who received the open-label placebo experienced improvements that were significantly greater than those reported by participants assigned to a no-pill control group. There was no difference in symptom improvements between those who received open-label or double-blind placebos. The results build on the research team's previous findings and challenge the long-held notion that concealment or deception are key elements in the placebo effect. The clinical response to open-label placebo in the 6-week trial was high, with 69% of participants who received open-label placebo reporting a clinically meaningful improvement in their symptoms, said first and corresponding author Anthony Lembo, professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology. Irritable bowel syndrome is one of the most common reasons for healthcare consultations and absenteeism from work or school. Effective treatment options are limited, and we hypothesized it may be possible to ethically harness the placebo effect for clinical benefit. If the presumption that deception is necessary for placebos to be effective is false, then many theories about the mechanisms that drive placebo effects may need modification, said another author who, with colleagues in 2010, published the results of the first randomized controlled trial to show that patients with irritable bowel syndrome responded well to treatment with open-label placebo. Subsequent research has demonstrated similar findings in patients with what they call subjective symptoms, including low back pain, knee pain, cancer-related fatigue, migraine headaches, menopausal hot flashes, and allergic rhinitis, which is allergies. Our finding that openly prescribed placebo may be as effective as double-blinded placebo has implications for clinical practice and for future research, especially in chronic visceral and somatic pain conditions. Okay, well, the pharmaceutical companies are not really happy with the placebo effect and would like it not to exist. This from Mad in America. Researchers attempt to reduce the placebo effect in drug trials. Pharmaceutical company researchers developed a tool to suppress the placebo effect and improve their drug results. Employees of several companies that conduct clinical trials for the pharmaceutical industry have just published a paper to test a tool intended to reduce the placebo effect in drug trials. It's called the Placebo Control Reminder Script, PCRS, and it was created by and licensed to several drug companies. Their study's goal was to demonstrate that the Placebo Control Reminder Script, or PCRS, when used in a clinical trial, can make the active drug look better by diminishing the improvement that people naturally experience in the placebo arm of the trial. Elon Cohen led the study at the Haussmann Research Institute. And all of the collaborating firms were funded by the pharmaceutical industry to conduct clinical trials. The study was published in Neuropsychopharmacology. Cohen et al. Write that the remarkably high and growing placebo response rates in clinical trials for CNS indications such as depression and schizophrenia. That's CNS means central nervous system, so many acronyms. Such as depression and schizophrenia constitute a major challenge for the drug development enterprise. Some researchers suggest that the strong placebo effect is a good thing, which could be harnessed to enable improvement without an active drug's adverse effects. For instance, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School have set up a program in placebo studies and therapeutic encounters that aims to enhance the placebo effect. That's the same group that reported on last story. Nonetheless, the placebo effect is quite troubling to the pharmaceutical industry, as their drugs have to be better than placebo, literally better than nothing, to be approved for use, and they often struggle to meet that mark. According to Cohen et al., drug development programs continue to face dauntingly low success rates in late-phase randomized placebo-controlled trials. The placebo effect, including natural improvement over time as well as an improvement due to expectations, is quite powerful when it comes to diagnoses like depression and schizophrenia. According to the authors, up to 50% of people taking a placebo find their depression improves, while for schizophrenia that number is 41%. In clinical trials of drugs intended to treat these disorders, the active drug is often no better or only slightly better than the placebo. When unpublished trials are included, only half of antidepressant studies find that the drug is better than the placebo. Researchers have suggested, in fact, that any supposed antidepressant effect of the most common class of antidepressant drugs may be entirely due to the placebo effect. There are several reasons for having a placebo-controlled study. First, the placebo group can indicate how many people would have improved anyway, even if they did not take the drug. This can include natural improvements over time and regression to the mean, in which the most severe cases improve significantly more. Second, the placebo group can indicate the effects of expectation. That is, people believe they are taking an active drug and so improve because they believe they will improve. But while these reasons are helpful to the consumer, they are dangerous to the pharmaceutical industry, since they make the active drug look less appealing. After all, if the same number of people improve on the drug or off it, when should the consumer take the drug? Cohen and other consultants believe that placebo-controlled reminder script can solve this problem. The script consists of a paragraph about the placebo effect that is first read aloud to the participant. Then the participant must repeat back the information to ensure they understand. The information includes advising the participant that they should not expect to feel better, that they should not expect the drug to work, and that they should know that they are in the placebo group if they experience no side effects. For instance, remember that the placebo is inactive and should do nothing to help your symptoms and should cause no side effects. In essence, the script is a technical and purposeful way to break the blinding of a study to ensure that the participants know whether they are receiving the active drug or not. Researchers already argue that accidentally breaking the blind of a study is a severe problem that biases the study's drug results. As Irving Kirsch writes in a peer-reviewed paper about antidepressant ineffectiveness, the difference in improvement between drug and placebo is not clinically meaningful and may be due to breaking blind by both patients and clinicians. It is unclear how it could be considered ethical to purposely create this bias in a clinical trial. To test their hypothesis that the script could stymie the placebo effect, Cohen et al. Conducted a two-week single-blind trial. Single-blind means that the participants didn't know which group they were in, but the researchers did. Since the researchers could be biased in single-blind trials, double-blind trials are considered more likely to provide less biased information. The consultants included 137 participants, all of whom met the criteria for current depression of at least moderate severity with no suicidal thoughts. Some had formal depression diagnoses, while others had diagnoses of schizophrenia or schizophreniform disorder. The participants were told that they were in a clinical trial for a new antidepressant and that to be split into two groups, one receiving the drug and one receiving the placebo. However, in reality, both groups received the placebo. The actual difference was that one group was also given the script while the other groups were not. Both groups improved over time, consistent with the natural course of depression and with the placebo effect. However, in line with Cohen et al.'s expectations, the group that received the placebo script showed less improvements than the group that didn't receive the placebo script. In the group that received the script, 30% believed they had improved. In the group without the script, 52% believed they had improved. Average depression scores dropped from about 30 to about 25 in a group that received the script. However, in the, quote, true placebo group who did not receive the script, average depression scores dropped to below 20, meaning that they no longer even met the criteria for moderate depression. That is, the true placebo group improved enough to no longer meet the criteria for depression severity that got them into the study in the first place, but those in the placebo script group improved only about half as much and still had moderate depression, according to the depression scores. So the placebo script works as intended. It helps stop people from getting better on their own. Cohen and other consultants write that their results demonstrate that the placebo script is a useful tool for the pharmaceutical industry's development of new drugs for psychiatric conditions. Briefly educating participants about placebo response factors can help mitigate the large placebo response rates that are increasingly seen in failed drug development programs, they write. By enhancing signal detection, such procedures may help drug developers progress compounds to faster approval and reach patients who are suffering sooner. Bah, humbug. Just another way to manipulate research design to get the results you want.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to switch gears here and go big with this study from Science Daily. A new way to measure human well-being towards sustainability. From science to implementation. How do we know if humankind is moving in the right directions towards global sustainability? The ambitious aim of the Sustainable Development Goals is a global call to action to end poverty, protect the planet, and ensure all people enjoy peace and prosperity by 2030. To monitor progress towards these goals, a set of over 220 indicators is used, but there's a danger that one can no longer see the forest for the trees. A single comprehensive indicator to assess the overall progress is needed. In a new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers and colleagues from the University of Vienna and the Bocconi University present an indicator based on life expectancy and benchmarks of objective and subjective well-being, the Years of Good Life Indicator. Many existing indicators of well-being do not consider the basic fact that being alive is a prerequisite for enjoying any quality of life. In addition, they often disregard the length of life. Life expectancy has long been used as a very comprehensive indicator of human development, with avoiding premature death being a universally shared aspiration. However, mere survival is not enough to enjoy life and its qualities, explains lead author Wolfgang Lutz. The Years of Good Life Indicator only counts a year as a good year if individuals are simultaneously not living in absolute poverty, free from cognitive and physical limitations, and report to be generally satisfied with their lives. The results show that years of good life differ substantially between countries. While in most developed countries, 20-year-old women can expect to have more than 50 years of good life left, with a record of 58 years in Sweden, women in the least developed countries can expect less than 15 years, with a record low of 10 years for women in Yemen. While life expectancy is higher for women than for men in every country, female years of good life are lower than those of males in most developing countries. This reveals a significant gender inequality in objective living conditions and subjective life satisfaction in most of these countries. And to drive home that gender difference, this from the World Health Organization. Devastatingly pervasive. One in three women globally experience violence. Violence against women remains devastatingly pervasive and starts alarmingly young, shows new data from the World Health Organization and partners. Across their lifetime, one in three women, around 736 million, are subjected to physical or sexual violence by an intimate partner or sexual violence from a non-partner, a number that has remained largely unchanged over the past decade. This violence starts early. One in four young women, aged 15 to 24 years, who have been in a relationship will have already experienced violence by an intimate partner by the time they reach their mid-20s. Violence against women is endemic in every country and culture, causing harm to millions of women and their families, and has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General. But unlike COVID-19, violence against women cannot be stopped with a vaccine. We can only fight it with deep-rooted and sustained efforts by governments, communities, and individuals to change harmful attitudes, improve access to opportunities and services for women and girls, and foster healthy and mutually respectful relationships. Intimate partner violence is by far the most prevalent form of violence against women globally, affecting around 641 million. However, 6% of women globally report being sexually assaulted by someone other than their husband or partner. Given the high levels of stigma and underreporting of sexual abuse, the true figure is likely to be significantly higher. Inequities are a leading risk factor for violence against women. Violence disproportionately affects women living in low and lower middle income countries. An estimated 37% of women living in the poorest countries have experienced physical and or sexual intimate partner violence in their life, with some of these countries have a prevalence as high as 1 in 2. The regions of Oceania, Southern Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa have the highest prevalence rates of intimate partner violence among women aged 15 to 49. The lowest rates are found in Europe, Central Asia, Eastern Asia, and Southeastern Asia. Violence against women must be prevented. Violence in all its forms can have an impact on a woman's health and well-being throughout the rest of her life, even long after the violence may have ended. It is associated with increased risk of injuries, depression, anxiety disorders, unplanned pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, including HIV, and many other health problems. It has impacts on society as a whole and comes with tremendous costs, impacting national budgets and overall development. Preventing violence requires addressing systemic, economic, and social inequalities, ensuring access to education and safe work, and changing discriminatory gender norms and institutions. Successful interventions also include strategies that ensure essential services are available and accessible to survivors, that support women's organizations, challenge inequitable social norms, reform discriminatory laws, and strengthen legal responses, among others. To address violence against women, there's an urgent need to reduce stigma around the issue, train health professionals to interview survivors with compassion, and dismantle the foundations of gender inequality. Interventions with adolescents and young people to foster gender equality and gender equitable attitudes are also vital. Countries should honor their commitments to increased and strong political will and leadership to tackle violence against women on all fronts through sound gender transformative policies, from policies around child care to equal pay and laws that support gender equality, a strengthened health system response that ensures access to survivor-centered care and referral to other services as needed, school and educational interventions to challenge discriminatory attitudes and beliefs, including comprehensive sexuality education, targeted investment in sustainable and effective evidence-based prevention strategies at local, national, regional, and global levels, and strengthening data collection and investing in high-quality surveys on violence against women and improving measurement of the different forms of violence experienced by women, including those who are most marginalized. And the single most important indicator for development in a developing country, the status of women. Okay, well, there's 7 bonus articles online for your reading pleasure. 1, criminal justice reform means reforming the mental health system. 2, toxic chemical hall of shame calls out major retailers for failing to act. 3, how safe is our drinking water, a consumer's reports investigation. 4, facing data gaps on trans populations, researchers turn to health records for answers. 5, the anti-science movement is escalating, going global, and killing thousands. 6, how to debunk misinformation about COVID, vaccines, and masks. And last but not least, 7th, resistance from health experts and business owners could doom so-called vaccine passports even before they launch. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.